I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Last night, Iran's military launched more than 20 ballistic missiles at two bases in Iraq that house U.S. and coalition forces in response to last week's killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani by the United States. It appears there were no casualties from those two attacks last night. Iran's foreign minister, Zarif, tweeted that Iran took and concluded appropriate measures in self-defense. We do not seek escalation or war, but will defend ourselves against any aggression. Iran's supreme leader called the missile strike a slap in the face to the United States. President Trump tweeted last night, all is well, and is scheduled to speak to the nation today at 11, which we will carry. While it looks like the crisis has been diffused at least temporarily, the hostile relationship between Iran and the United States goes back decades, our topic for today's Radio Times. And joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Ervan Abrahamian, professor emeritus of history at the City University of New York. He was born in Iran, wrote a book called The Coup, 1953, The CIA and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. Ervan Abrahamian, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes, good morning. Hi.
Hi, nice to have you with us. We have a lot to talk about. Let me get our second guest in on our conversation. Narges Bajoghli is assistant professor of Middle East Studies at the School of Advanced and International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of a book called Iran Reframed: Anxieties in Power in the Islamic Republic, and it's based on some 10 years of research in Iran on the IRGC, that's the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, also known as the Quds Force. And Narges Bajoghli, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, if I could, Narges. Last night, I'll be honest with you, I was watching TV and it looked like we were headed for war with Iran. What is your assessment this morning?
It seems like Iran took a measure to actually de-escalate the situation for now. So the Iranian authorities had said that, and have said since the attack, that they had let the Iraqi forces know beforehand that the attack was going to be launched, and they launched it at a military site, and no casualties were reported. So then, therefore, and then the statements from the foreign minister that came afterwards from Iran again reiterated that they're not looking for a war with or an escalation of war with the United States. So it seems that they took a military action in order to retaliate for the assassination of Soleimani, but did so in a manner that would put the ball back in Trump's court, but not invite further escalation unless he chooses to.
In fact, some of the news coming from the Pentagon today, Professor Abrahamian, is that Iran missed on purpose.
Yes, it's possible. I mean, what was actually interesting before the attack, the statement from the Iranian National Security Council was that where they would take retribution for the assassination of Soleimani, but they would do it openly and it would not be done basically undercover. This was, I think, a very clear message that they didn't want third parties who would love to have a major confrontation between Iran and the United States triggering off something. So they wanted to make it clear that when there was retribution, it would be done by the Iranians openly. And this is, and what they did was clearly this missile attack was an open Iranian attack, and maybe they intentionally designed it not to actually injure or kill anyone.
When you talk about third parties, Professor, what are you referring to?
There are obviously third parties in the Middle East that would love to have a major confrontation. Israel has been itching for some sort of confrontation, getting United States involved. There's also Daesh, or what they call themselves, the Caliphate. The remnants of that would love to have the confrontation. In fact, so far, they're sitting pretty with the conflict, with the heightened tensions between the U.S. and Iran. After all, Daesh was, in fact, contained and apparently defeated by a combination of United States, Iran, and Iraq. So with that alliance breaking down, it gives them a wonderful opportunity to revive. And, of course, there are Iranian groups like the Mujahideen who've been itching for America to attack Iran. So there are all these other groups that could have easily triggered off some sort of a major escalation that would have got out of control.
And Daesh, we also refer to them as ISIS, just to make sure that our listeners know who you were referring to. Narges Bajogli, I'm sorry for screwing up your name there. What do you want President Trump to say today?
What do I want him to say?
Yes. Whether he will say it or not.
Well, what I would hope that he would say is that that the Iranians have given us their response for the assassination of Soleimani, and that negotiations should start between the United States and Iran. Whether he will actually say that or not, I don't know. But this could be a potential opening to try to de-escalate tensions in the region, and I hope it's an opening that he might take, although it's he is such an unpredictable figure that it's I have no idea what he's actually going to be saying.
Do you think Iran wants to open negotiations with the U.S.?
Iran has said that it's always been willing to talk with the United States, but the U.S. needs to take off the sanctions that it imposed after it left the Iran deal and imposed really crippling economic sanctions against Iran. So Iran has said that it has no problem talking with the U.S. as long as the U.S. takes off the sanctions, and then they could talk about negotiations moving forward.
Professor, let me go back to you. And I mean, in this country, Major General Qasem Soleimani is called a terrorist. But it's clear in Iran, looking at the funeral where just untold numbers of people poured into the streets for his funeral, that he is held in very high regard. Help us understand how the Iranian people have viewed him.
Because he was actually he wasn't in charge of the Revolutionary Guards. That's often a misconception. He was in charge of the section of the Revolutionary Guards that dealt with outside groups, such as with the Syrian government, with the Afghan government, with the Iraqi government, and perhaps with the Yemen Houthis. Basically was the person known outside, and therefore I think his role was overly exaggerated in the foreign press. But because he had played such an important role in fighting Daesh, or you call it ISIS or the Caliphate, he was seen as an Iranian hero for that. He was often in the battlefield, actually, risking his life in that. And he was described as a walking martyr, i.e., it was expected that sooner or later he would get killed, not necessarily by the Americans, but by the ISIS. So in that way, he had this image of a fighter, of willing to basically risk his life for the cause. The American view that he's a terrorist is a little self-serving, because there were periods, in fact, the U.S. worked very closely with the Quds, his part of the Revolutionary Guards. The Revolutionary Guards, in fact, played a, it's forgotten here, important role in helping the United States in Afghanistan against the Taliban. It also played an important role in calming down the Sunni and Shi'i uprising against the American troops at the worst period of the American occupation of Iraq. And it was later blamed for the bombings of Americans. But in fact, Iran and Soleimani tried to calm down the Shi'i uprising at that time. They persuaded Sadr, who was the main spokesman of the Shi'i revolt, to withdraw from politics and go and study for a PhD in a seminary in outside Tehran. So this was at that time seen as actually that he was cooperating and helping United States in trying to calm the situation. And of course, the ultimate cooperation with him was just only a few months ago when the attack on the ISIS occurred in Mosul, it was both the U.S., Iran, and the Iraqi government and the paramilitary groups that are Iraqi but are funded and helped by, armed by the Iranians that finally contained ISIS. So there were periods where the U.S. didn't mind working with him. Then now suddenly he's described as a major terrorist.
Well, Professor Bajoghli, you have looked at the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, wrote a book about them. And help us understand, I guess, the role that they have played. And one of the reasons we want to do the show is that there's so much about this relationship between the U.S. and Iran that we do not understand. But help us understand the IRGC.
Yeah, so the IRGC came into formation after the revolution in 1979. When Khomeini came back to Iran with the triumph of the revolution, he was initially worried that there might be a coup posed against the new revolutionary forces by the formal military in Iran, known as the Artish in Persian, because he thought that they would remain loyal to the Shah. And so they created this force, the Revolutionary Guard, as initially a force to defend the revolution from any sort of potential coup. And it was then sent to domestic places within the country, to the Kurdish area, as well as the Turkoman region of the country, when there were uprisings there against the central government in Iran because of the revolution. So it was actually first an internal force. When Saddam Hussein invaded Iran in September of 1980, and it was being logistically supported by the United States and Western powers, Iran not only had to then send its a formal military, the Artish, to defend against this invasion, but also the Revolutionary Guard that sent to the borders to fight in the war. Over the eight-year Iran-Iraq war, which I think often gets forgotten outside of those two countries, it's a really important war to think about because it has it shifted the geopolitics of the region quite significantly. So the Iran-Iraq war was the longest conventional war of the 20th century. Trench warfare was used. It was a very bloody war. Chemical weapons were used en masse by the Iraqis against Iran. And throughout this war, this is the war in which the Revolutionary Guard really sort of began to develop as a force. It's where they began to learn how to effectively do asymmetrical warfare because they were up against an army again that was being supplied monetarily, logistically, and by weapons from much more powerful forces from the outside. And Iran was right in, coming out of a revolution, so in much disarray. So throughout the 8 years, by the end of the eight-year war, the Revolutionary Guard had become a parallel force to the formal military. It had ground forces, air forces, and naval forces.
And I do want to pick up on that. I'm sorry to do that after this very short break. Talking with Narges Bajoghli and also Arvan Abrahamian about the U.S.-Iran conflict. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're talking about the longstanding contentious relationship between the United States and Iran. Last night, Iran launched a number of ballistic missile attacks against two bases in Iraq where U.S. troops and coalition forces have been housed. Ervan Abrahamian is professor emeritus of history at the City University of New York, author of a book called The Coup, 1953, The CIA and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. He was born in Iran. Narges Bajoghli is assistant professor of Middle East Studies at the School of Advanced and International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, author of a book called Iran Reframed, Anxieties and Power in the Islamic Republic. Professor Bajoghli, let me just go back to you just for a moment or two. You talked about the importance of the Iran-Iraq war in understanding the IRGC. Help us understand then the role that Major General Qasem Soleimani has played with the IRGC.
So Soleimani fought throughout the eight-year Iran-Iraq war. And then it was later that after that war, later he got involved in the Quds forces, which, as Professor Abrahamian explained, is the forces of the IRGC that that function outside of the national territories of Iran. So what is really important about, again, understanding the role of the Iran-Iraq war in the formation of the IRGC is two quick things. One is they began to learn how to do asymmetrical warfare. And then the second is many of the top echelons of Iran's Revolutionary Guard commanders, as well as the leaders, got their knowledge and understanding and point of view of international affairs from fighting in that war. Mm. And what became important to understand from that is that their view of the ways in which the United States runs proxy warfare in the region all comes from having fought in that eight-year war. So one of the reasons in which Qasem Soleimani ends up becoming so important in the Quds forces, as well as other folks who are in the Quds forces who all come out of the Iran-Iraq war, is that they take the experiences of fighting there into then the ways in which they engage with their partners and allies in the region as further escalations from the U.S. and Israel continue in the region.
Well, let me go back even further with you, Professor Abrahamian, to understand this Iran-U.S. relationship. We should go back to the 1950s under the Eisenhower administration when the U.S. and Britain overthrew the leader Mossadegh. He was a secularist. He was a nationalist. Why did they want him gone?
It's complicated, but the main reason was that Mossadegh, as a way of asserting Iranian independence from the West, especially from Britain, nationalized the oil company was British-owned. And this is often seen as purely an Iran versus Britain conflict. In fact, the nationalization of the oil directly affected American interests, because the fear in Washington was that if Iran succeeded in nationalizing its oil, this virus would quickly spread throughout the world, and other oil countries, such as the Saudis, Indonesia, Venezuela, other countries where American interests were, would also nationalize their oil. So there was a great deal of pressure from American oil companies. They didn't need to put the pressure on, but the State Department, even under the Truman administration, was adamant that this type of nationalization should not succeed. Mm. At first, they tried to persuade Mossadegh to sort of back down and accept a meaningless form of nationalization. When it was clear that they couldn't do that, they basically decided to remove him.
Well, let's jump to the 1979, the Iranian Revolution, the taking of the U.S. embassy, American hostages as well. Professor Bajoghli, if I can go to you, what has explained the staying power of the revolution and the government of Iran?
What explains their staying power?
Yeah, in terms of the clerically led regime has survived 40 years now. What explains that?
There are a number of things that explain this. One, I think it's really important to understand that the revolution of 1979 was a popular revolution from below, in which one of the main slogans of the revolution was neither East nor West, meaning neither the Soviet Union nor the United States. It really was, going back to what Professor Abrahamian was saying, sort of this continuation of the ways in which Iranians were trying to establish sovereignty and independence in the country away from external powers. So one of the reasons in which the hostage crisis takes place sort of goes back to that history. But the staying power of the Islamic Republic is that, first of all, there were a lot of social welfare programs that were created after the revolution that benefited a very large portion of the population. Even though the Shah of Iran prior to the revolution was a very close ally to the U.S., there were significant portions of the population who were very impoverished. And after the revolution, there were big programs put into place to extend electricity, for example, and water to rural areas all throughout the country, even during the Iran-Iraq war. So by the time that the war ends and we go into the 1990s, Literacy rates have begun to shoot up across the country. By now, you have almost universal literacy rates, whereas at the time of the revolution, it was fairly low. You also have, again, social welfare programs. You have education spread throughout the country. So the emphasis outside of Iran about the revolution and the aftermath of the revolution has really sort of been this obsession over this Islamic theocracy. And that has, I think, damaged our understanding in a much more complex way of the different ways in which society developed in these 40 years since 1979. So as there are a lot of critiques of the Islamic Republic domestically in Iran, there are a lot of moments of protest against the Islamic Republic for its political repression. However, one of the reasons that we can understand its staying power is looking at its social policies throughout these 40 years, which have, to an extent, despite severe sanctions on the government for more or less much of these past 40 years, they have been able to develop the country to an extent that has the buy-in of at least a large enough segment of the population that sort of wards off anything leaning towards another form of revolution to come, you know, up until this point.
Well, Professor Abrahami, if I can go back to you, there were protests against the government in Iran in the fall. Has the drone strike killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani, in a sense, unified the country in a way that it wasn't unified before the attack against Soleimani?
Very much so. I think I'm actually surprised that Iran carried out these attacks in Iraq yesterday, because they could have easily declared a victory over what Trump had done. I mean, Trump had actually given on a platter a series of victories for Iran by unifying the whole country. As you said, a few months ago, there were demonstrations against the government. Now, even people who have criticism of the government will rally behind the government. Similarly, actually, in Iraq, where there were demonstrations against the Iraqi government and also against Iran, that has all stopped. The public opinion very much in Iraq is against the United States, because they see it as an assassination of even an Iraqi leader on Iraqi territory as a violation of their sovereignty. So, and there are many other things you could use to show that basically the assassination gave Iran a Trump card they could have used politically. But I think the question of basically retribution was there. So they felt they needed to do something to act as if they're it's tit for tat. But going back to what Narges was saying about the social programs, which it ties actually to the military aspect. When we talk so much about the Revolutionary Guards, that could lead to a misconception that Iran is a military power, it's a militaristic society with the real power basically the importance of the state is on the military. But if you look at their military expenditures, it's pitifully small compared to neighbors. Bulk of the oil income over the last 30 years has really gone into social programs. Compared to the Shah's regime, military expenditures have been really drastically reduced. And you compare the annual military expenditure of Iran to, let's say, Saudi Arabia or even United Arab Emirates, it's about a tenth of it, the expenditures. Mm. So the Revolutionary Guard is not really a big military power. I would describe it more as a militia or a national guard of people who are basically lightly armed. They can carry out asymmetrical warfare, but they are not armed heavily with tanks, aeroplanes, bombers, and stuff like that that usually the military takes seriously. So I would say the connection of why the regime has survived is very much tied to the way it has de-escalated its military expenditures compared to the previous regime.
That's Arvan Abrahamian. He's a professor emeritus of history at City University of New York, born in Iran. We are talking about U.S.-Iran relations. Narges Bajogli is assistant professor of Middle East studies at Johns Hopkins University. And you can join our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499 and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Professor Bajogli, let me go back to you. And where does then the nuclear agreement that the United States pulled out of, where does that stand today? Iran made some statements about the agreement. Are they in? Are they out? Where does it stand?
Iran was very clear on Sunday when it made the new statements about the JCPOA, the Iran deal, that it is still in the Iran deal. It has not pulled out. All of all of the actions that they have taken thus far as their centrifuges and all of that, are within the framework of the Iran deal. They still have said that if other parties come back to the deal, they are willing to talk within the framework of it. So they have not left it. They've been very adamant, I think. And also, it's important to note that they were, especially after the Soleimani assassination, are playing a very interesting political game, because with the assassination of Soleimani, they're not trying to create another news round by talking about leaving the Iran deal altogether. So I think they've put that on the back burner for now. They haven't said that they haven't put out a deadline for making another announcement yet. So for all intents and purposes, the Iran deal is still there. They're allowing IAEA inspectors to still come into Iran. They haven't sort of made any drastic cuts to any of that. And I think they are continue to try to put pressure on the EU to make good on their promise of keeping the Iran deal alive.
A Facebook comment from Tommy, who says, average Americans think they know that Iran wants, quote, death to America and Israel. I worry that these sentiments alone are going to advance public support for a war. Professor Abrahamian, if I can go back to you, what does death to America mean when we hear that chanted in Iran?
It's a slogan. I mean, it's it shouldn't be taken literally. It's in the past, it was also used in demonstrations in the 20s, 30s. Usually, anyone you don't like, it's down with so and so or death so and so. But it's not a literal political demand that people take seriously. It's often, I would say, it's a sort of carnival show of protest against the U.S. And I think that it's person who called it is important, because it is taken literally in America, mm-hmm. and the average American, of course, has then the right to be pissed off at it. But in the Iranian context, it should be seen as less of more of a rhetoric rather than a literal policy.
Well, we have just a couple of more minutes before we have to say goodbye. And to you, Professor Bajogli, then what will you be looking for or watching for today and over the next couple of days as we see where this crisis is going to take us?
So those who seem to be advising President Trump on Iran seem to want regime collapse and the most ultimate case of a regime change. Under these circumstances, and especially after the killing of Soleimani, the regime at this point in time is stronger than it was even just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, the crowds that we saw in the funeral of Soleimani would have been unthinkable a week and a half ago, because of the anger that existed in Iran due to the severe crackdown of the state against protesters in November. So I think moving forward, what I am going to be looking for is to see what the Trump administration does. If they continue their program of their policy of maximum pressure, which I think is important to note, it is not just a policy of maximum sanctions against Iran, but there's also a lot of cyber attacks happening, covert actions taking place. So in this situation, Iran is still very much cornered. If it continues in that way, there will be different ways in which Iran will try to retaliate in order to make this situation untenable. And so it will be interesting to see, and what I'll be looking for is, will Trump double down on maximum pressure, or will they take this as an opportunity to potentially start some form of dialogue with Iran to de-escalate tensions or not?
And to you, Professor Abrahamian, a similar question, but are we going down the same path as we did with the Iraq war?
Well, I'm optimistic in the short run. I don't think there's going to be a basically escalation and a crisis in the short run. But in the long run, I'm not pretty pessimistic, especially if Trump is reelected, that there's bound to be some type of war. But there's another dimension to this. Iran has politics. It has elections. People compete. And parliamentary elections are due very soon, next month. And because of this heightened crisis, and you can see the demonstrations in the street, it adds fuel to the, I would call, the right-wing populists. They're going to sweep into the parliament. Hmm. And they had always been suspicious of the nuclear deal. They're going to have much more say. Rouhani may still be president, but his cabinet may be much more full of right-wing populists. And they could very well argue that, well, the nuclear deal has been killed by Trump. Why should we abide by it? And basically go for full enrichment, in which case then, of course, the crisis then escalates. And then the ball is back into American court. And, of course, there's always Israel at the background insisting that the world cannot survive with Iran having a nuclear program. Mm. And that would lead us directly to war.
And that is something I will pick up with our third guest. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Professor Ervan Abrahamian, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And same to you, Professor Nargis Bajogli. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Just a recap here. Last night, Iran launched more than 20 ballistic missiles against two bases in Iraq that house U.S. and coalition forces. This was in retaliation for the drone strike killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. last week. There are no reported casualties from last night's attack. The assassination jump-started a crisis in an already crisis-prone part of the world. There have been conflicting messages coming from the Trump administration about this crisis and its Mideast policy. President Trump is scheduled to speak today at 11 o'clock, which we will carry here on WHYY. We asked Joe Cirincione to join us. He is the president of the Plowshares Fund. That's a global security foundation. Also the host of Press the Button podcast from the Plowshares Fund, dealing with nuclear policy and nuclear security. And Joe Cirincione, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Where do we stand today? I spoke with our previous two guests saying last night, as I was frankly watching television, I was worried we were on our way to war. Where do you think things stand today?
I'm impressed by the restrained nature of the Iranian strike. I think there are some in the Trump camp that are sort of crowing about this, thinking this is a victory. We killed one of their top generals, and all they did was lob 22 missiles into bases in Iraq. But I think the Iranians are very calculated about this. They don't do these things in the sort of hyper-masculine way that maybe Trump thinks about them. You hit me, I'm going to hit you back harder. No, this is about accomplishing their strategic objectives. What do they want? Ayatollah Khomeini said what they wanted just last night. We want the U.S. forces out of the region. Well, he is about to get that objective. So he doesn't want this strike to upset that departure. The Iraqi parliament has already asked, and the Iraqi prime minister has already asked U.S. forces to leave the region. It appears that that is going to happen. If they leave Iraq, then they're almost certainly going to leave Syria. That puts Iranian forces in a stronger hand. This killing of Soleimani has also united the Iranian population around an otherwise unpopular regime that is also in his favor. So I'm impressed with the sort of a deft touch the Iranians are showing.
Let me ask you a couple of questions. One is the word, and I'm not sure how official it is, but word sort of leaking out of the Pentagon that Iran intentionally missed whatever target they might have in that there were no casualties. Also that these ballistic missiles were launched from Iran, not from proxies or from the Quds force. It was coming from the Iranian military, and they seem to be high-precision missiles. As a weapons expert yourself, what do you make of all of that?
The Iranians have made great advances in the last 10 years on the sophistication of the propulsion systems and the guidance systems of their missiles. Look at the Saudi strike just last year, where people were stunned to see when they launched, about a dozen cruise missiles in this case, at a Saudi oil facility. These were very precise strikes. Nine of them were bullseyes, right at the tanks that they were aiming for. So it's possible that these missiles, these are bigger missiles, ballistic missiles, longer range missiles, have the kind of guidance where they might have been intentionally aimed at empty spots in the airbase. In other words, again, a sign of a restrained attack. They're sending a signal. We could hit you. We chose not to. This attack, missiles from Iran at U.S. forces at an Iraqi airbase, was unthinkable last week before the killing of Soleimani. Now the Iranians are saying, we can reach out and touch you. Be careful what you do next.
You mentioned the fact that Iran and Iraq have both said publicly they want the United States to leave. I believe there's something like 5,000 troops in Iraq. I was reading this morning, and it seems like the United States is saying, no, we're not. Are we on the road to another kind of conflict then?
Well, like so much about the Trump administration, this situation is completely confused. It's been very unclear what's happening with their forces in Iraq, what President Trump's strategy is. And part of this is due to the devastation that in our national security apparatus. You know, a dozen people have already cycled through the jobs of Secretary of Defense, Homeland Security, Director of National Intelligence, National Security Advisor. So there's a weak structure around Donald Trump. He himself, of course, is erratic and very impulsive. So it's not a surprise that the U.S. policy and whether we're going to stay or whether we go is up in the air. But I think at this point it's going to be very, very hard to keep U.S. forces in Iraq, even though some Iraqis, like the Kurds and the Sunnis, would like us to stay. The Shia majority want us out.
The New York Times reported over the weekend that members of the military were briefing President Trump, giving him various options, and they included an option to kill Soleimani, thinking that he wouldn't take it. When he did, they were shocked. And my feeling, my question to you is, Joe Cirincione, after 3 years, you would think the military would know better than to give the president an option like that.
You would think. Now, I worked on Capitol Hill for 10 years, and we would brief members all the time like this. We would bracket the option we wanted them to choose with an option that was too weak and an option that was too strong, knowing they would go for the one in the middle. So I understand that. But with this kind of president, that really was foolish. And in this case, it might have been put there not just for this kind of psychological purpose, but because Secretary of State Mike Pompeo really wanted it. We know now, and the reporting on this has been very good in the last couple of days, that Mike Pompeo has been pushing to assassinate Soleimani for months. He has wanted to do this. He wanted to do it after the strikes on the Saudi oil facility. He wanted to do it after the tanker attacks earlier last year in the Gulf. He wanted to get him. So I would look more for that explanation of why it was on rather than simply trying to manipulate a policymaker.
And that's Joe Cirincione, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times, president of the Plowshares Fund. We're talking about the standoff, the conflict between the United States and Iran. Iran. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Faradun has a comment. He says, I'm from Iran, and Trump is making a disaster out of the Middle East. He's killing Iranians. He does not respect us. All his administration is looking for is fast money. And that's obviously an opinion from an Iranian who's here in the United States. Do you think, Joe, there's appetite in this country for another conflict in the Middle East?
Absolutely not. You know, there's been a lot of comparisons about the run-up to the war in Iraq back in 2002 to 2003. I was an opponent of that war as an expert. I thought that Saddam Hussein might have some weapons of mass destruction, but we had the process in place, inspectors, etc., that could determine that. There was no need for an invasion. It was clear we were manipulated into that war by cherry-picking intelligence and hyped threats linking Saddam Hussein to terrorists like al-Qaeda. That is exactly what the administration is doing now, calling them terrorists, and therefore it's justified to strike at them, that somehow we have the authorization to do that. Not true, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the difference. Mm-hmm. Back in 2002, 2003, the American public wanted to strike back. Remember, we were still reeling from the 9/11 attacks. It's exactly the opposite now. It's 18, 19 years later, a war-weary American public. They're tired of seeing caskets land at Dover Air Force Base. The troops come back maimed, killed, or psychologically injured. The American public wants out of the war. The polls are absolutely clear. So it's going to be very, very difficult for President Trump to whip up a kind of war fever that would launch a brand new war, that would get us into a war with Iran, that would make the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan look like warm-up acts. This is a major country with formidable military capability. It would be a devastating war, and it would chip the global economy into recession, tanking the stock markets and probably sinking Trump's reelection chances. That, more than any of the calculations I have just mentioned, is probably why Donald Trump is going to restrain his hand, probably why we'll hear in his speech later this morning an appeal to sort of stand down rather than mount a new attack on Iran.
President Trump criticized President Obama for the nuclear deal. Where does the deal stand? The Islamic Republic made an announcement yesterday, and it sounds like it's both got its foot, I guess, in the deal, but and it's willing to cooperate with the International Atomic Agency. But where does that stand from your perspective?
Well, Iran announced further steps away from the limitations it's subject to under the deal. Remember, this deal rolled back Iran's program to a fraction of its size before the agreement, froze it in place for at least 20 years, and put it under the strictest inspection regime on the planet. The inspection regime remains in place. That's the real good news. But they are now moving steadily away from the limitations, installing more centrifuges, enriching uranium to a slightly higher level. Don't worry, they can't race to a bomb. Iran does not have a nuclear weapon. They are not about to get a nuclear weapon, but they start to increase their capacity to build a weapon should they decide to do so in a year or two or longer. So the deal is actually still alive. As Billy Crystal said in The Princess Bride, it's not all dead, it's mostly dead. Wow. And mostly dead is slightly alive, meaning should there be a Democratic president elected who wants to go back into the deal in January, a year from now, that deal will still be there as a framework for reining in the Iranian nuclear program. If we go to war, of course, if this crisis escalates, all bets are off, and I would expect Iran at that point to leave the deal completely.
One of our previous guests this morning was worried that if right-wingers, as he called them, in Iran were elected, that they might put pressure on the president of Iran to withdraw from the deal and say, we're just going to go ahead and build our nuclear weapons.
I heard the end of that interview, and I think he's right. It's not just hardliners in the U.S. and Israel that were against this agreement. It was hardliners in Iran. They think Iran should get a weapon. They should get a bomb. And everything they've seen from President Trump validates that assumption as far as they're concerned. So, yes, you could see pressure. You will see pressure mount inside Iran to pull out of the deal faster and faster. I think Ayatollah Khamenei, again, is playing chess. He moves a little more slowly. He puts his pieces in place. He's increasing Iran's options without actually going so far as to completely alienate Iran from the Europeans, from the Russians and the Chinese. He's playing this very well. I would say Trump has lost so far in this. Yes, he killed Soleimani, but he's alienated U.S. allies. He's reduced the credibility of the United States. He's made people here in America afraid that that he could launch us into another devastating war. You see the memes on Twitter, somewhat exaggerated about the draft and World War III. Right. But he's scared people, and not in a good way. I think the Iranians so far are coming out ahead in this crisis. Let's hope it de-escalates from here and doesn't. And there's not another American miscalculation or an Iranian miscalculation that plunges us into a war that I don't think either side really wants.
Well, let me ask you about ISIS. And, you know, curiously and interestingly, and I guess this just tells you how complicated this part of the world is, the United States and Iran were on the same side fighting against ISIS. While their troops being sent to the Middle East, also the troops who have been going after ISIS have been put on hold, at least temporarily. How does that factor into our understanding?
Yeah, the two things. This is another as a setback from the assassination, the Soleimani killing, is that U.S. forces are now no longer engaged in joint operations with the Iraqis, which is what we're doing. That's why we're still in Iraq. The 5,000 troops there are there to fight ISIS, not fight Iran. Mm-hmm. You know, and now those missions have stopped, and they're in defensive postures, no longer doing offensive work. So that's a setback for the U.S. And as I say, I think they're going to have to leave, and that will be a setback for the fight against ISIS. Number two, you know, there's a long history here. Sometimes Iran is portrayed as irrevocably opposed to the U.S. and constantly attacking us. But we allied with the Iranians to overthrow the Taliban in Afghanistan. I mean, that was a joint U.S.-Iranian-Afghan operation that was extremely successful. And U.S. commanders were communicating indirectly with Soleimani during that time every week, every day. It wasn't until the U.S. invasion of Iraq and then the counterinsurgency operations mounted by the Iraqis that Iran started getting involved, aiding Iraqi militias allied with Iran, and that's where we saw Iran and Soleimani actually doing things that were ending up killing U.S. troops. But even after that, we again allied with the Iranians in the fight against ISIS. When ISIS was on the gates of Baghdad, it was the Iranians and the Americans working with the Iraqis to push them back. It shows that there are ways to cooperate with Iran, even if we disagree with the government, we don't like what they're doing. There are ways to cooperate with them the way we cooperate, frankly, with other autocratic and repressive regimes in the region.
So are you saying there is enough goodwill that we can sit down with the Iranians?
Not anytime soon. I mean, this is not going to be the kind of dramatic turning point where we achieve a pause in the military conflict and now there's room for talks. I don't think there's any appetite on the Iranian side for these kinds of talks. President Trump has shown that he's not very good at negotiations. You know, look how he mishandled the North Korea situation. Is it a possibility? Yes. I wouldn't build up hope. But in more deft hands, with the State Department that was actually fully operational, with the national security apparatus that hadn't been shattered the way this one has been, yes, there are ways to talk with Iran, to cooperate with Iran on our mutual strategic objectives.
Well, we have to leave it there. Joe Cirincione, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's always a pleasure.
A pleasure to have you on as well. And again, he's president of the Plowshares Fund. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Aaronson, Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.